طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Those of us concerned about the future of the Palestinian people view that future with increasing trepidation, not only because of the increasing severity of the Israeli military occupation, the continuing financial and political support of the United States, but also because of the unstable political environment and lack of leadership. Hamas rules Gaza. Fatah rules the West Bank, and the parties are continually at each other's throats. Mahmoud Abbas is the last elected president, and he continues to serve because no elections have been held in Palestine since 2006, and none are planned in the future. Why is the political scene so chaotic, and where is the new Palestinian leadership? In our first feature presentation, those questions are put to Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi by Nader Hashemi at a conference sponsored by the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies.
Okay, Rashid, first of all, welcome to the Center for Middle East Studies. I want to sort of shift the conversation from the discussions and debates you've been having since you arrived here and focus on a topic of which you are, in many ways, the leading global expert on. And that's the question of Palestinian nationalism, in particular, Palestinian leadership. And one of the, I think, tragedies of the Palestinian national movement and the Palestinian people's struggle for national self-determination, in my view, has been the colossal failure of an effective leadership to represent them, to push forward their democratic and national agenda. And so, you know, there's a question here that needs to be answered. And of course, it can't be done in a few minutes, but I want to just pick your brain a bit and ask you the first question. What went wrong? How did a movement, how did a cause that was very popular throughout the Arab Islamic world, with the Third World, end up where we are today? And how would you sort of explain, just in broad terms, how this leadership ended up really, you know, failing in such a colossal manner?
Well, I actually wrote a book called The Iron Cage, in which I tried to set out my understanding of this problem in a very long perspective, going back to the beginning of the 20th century and focusing especially on the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and explaining, trying to explain why there were leadership failures in that era, and then showing how the next generation of leadership, which emerged in the 40s and 50s and was responsible for the renaissance of the Palestinian national movement from the 60s onwards, differed from the previous leadership in class and in educational and in aspirational terms. And I tried to be fair to them because they were extraordinarily successful in both reunifying Palestinian ranks, creating a relatively unified national movement, appealing to Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and world audiences from the 60s through the 80s. But this is where the problems emerge. Firstly, this leadership was subject to a relentless campaign of assassinations. And I have to say that most of the best of that generation, who by now actually are quite long in the tooth in any case, but most of the best of that generation were eliminated systematically one by one, most of them by Israeli efforts, but some of them by the efforts of Arab governments. I mean, a large number of them were killed by groups that were manipulated by either Syrian or Libyan or Iraqi intelligence services. And I think that at a certain point, they lost touch with their mass base, especially after the departure from Beirut of the PLO leadership. They were in Tunis and in Yemen, in places very far away from concentrations of Palestinian population. They were dependent on a diplomatic strategy that was in many ways faulty. They had more or less given up the idea of putting pressure on Israel through armed struggle, which had not succeeded very well in any case. And brilliant analysts like Iqbal Ahmed had told the PLO leadership that this was not going to work, and they had not been willing to listen. But in any case, it had more or less ceased to be a major element of their strategy. And when the First Intifada came along, it was a manna from heaven for them. The First Intifada was the first significant Palestinian strategic victory, I would argue, in the whole course of Palestinian struggle.
Right.
You could say that, to some extent, that the successes of the PLO in establishing a new representative of the Palestinians was another important success,
right,
in the 60s and 70s. But perhaps even more important than that was that the Intifada showed the world what occupation was like,
right,
showed the Israelis,
right,
that the status quo could not,
yeah,
continue. But unfortunately, that victory was frittered away in the negotiations of the 90s and the early 2000s. And that's where I think this leadership has really failed.
To what extent, really, here's the problem, is the individual character of Arafat and his closest advisors? I mean, to what extent can we sort of, you know, focus on the failure of leadership, on the individual of Arafat himself and the decisions that he made that has led us to where we are today?
You know, I would make an argument that this is a broader problem than just the Mufti in the 30s or just Arafat in the 80s or any individual. I think that you have a style of leadership in much of the Arab world, the Zaim,
right,
the single leader style. Arafat was part of a much more collegial leadership than a lot of these countries have had. But he was first among equals. And that style is one problem. A second problem is being distant from the people and not having to defend yourself in front of a representative assembly. And over time, the PLO became less and less representative,
right,
less and less of a live, functioning, organically sound body. And it's a shell now. So I think Arafat personally, you can describe a lot of these problems as functions of his personality.
Mm-hmm.
But I think an overstress on the individual personality of this or that leader is probably a mistake. I fault him a great deal in that book, The Iron Cage.
Right.
Him personally. I fault the Mufti a great deal personally. But I think these are broader structural issues. And I think that being in a situation where you're cut off, in particular, from that majority of Palestinians who live outside of Palestine, was a devastating blow from 82 onwards.
But this is not unique to the Palestinian national movement. The ANC were cut off from their own society, but they were able to organize a very effective.
True.
So how does one explain the difference?
And Kurdish national movements.
And Kurdish national movements.
Have been, in some cases,
and
cut off.
And East Timorese, there's many others.
Right.
I think there's a deeper,
right,
sort of set of problems here.
Right, I think you're probably
diagnosed.
Right. You're probably right. You're probably right.
Well, let me push you a bit on that. I had an interview with the late Israel Shahak on this before he passed away. And he said one of the problems that resulted in the corruption and failure of the PLO was that there was just too much money that they had access to that bred corruption, and it was a byproduct of the Arab state system, the Arab League, buying off people, and that led to a certain lack of democratic accountability. And if you contrast that with other national liberation movements, they had to be much more efficient. They didn't have those resources.
Right.
To what extent do you buy into that argument?
Well, that was already a problem in Beirut before 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a problem partly because Arafat used money and perks and so on and so forth and patronage as a means of buying loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
But the PLO in Beirut was in a situation of war. And so those phenomena,
right,
even though they were harmful, were not the primary phenomena. I mean, you basically had to provide food, or you basically had to provide fuel,
right,
or you basically had to have ammunition,
right,
or you basically had to have some kind of security and some kind of governance. And those overwhelmingly imperative tasks in a situation of war, I mean, we're talking about war in Lebanon from 73,
right,
really, when the Lebanese army,
right,
attacks the camps first,
right,
until 1982,
right,
meant that these phenomena were not as important as they became. But that period of complete idleness in Tunis or Yemen or wherever, from 82 until they returned in the mid-90s, was catastrophic. Mm-hmm. It destroyed the PLO, mm-hmm. in my view. Mm-hmm. It destroyed it as a functioning organization. Mm-hmm. The people who came back were hollow shells.
Yeah.
And when they arrived in the West Bank and Gaza, they shocked people
yeah.
by their emptiness, by their hollowness, right. by their lack of any kind of apparent commitment to
right.
the cause.
Right.
They expected now to be received like heroes, to achieve status, and not have to do anything right. in return. They felt that they had won.
Right.
Here we are, we're back, we're going to govern you, we deserve this, and so on and so on. So this is more than, this is worse and deeper than just corruption.
Right.
When you then add to that the lavish funding that came in terms of taxes that Israel, or customs duties that Israel allowed to the Palestinian Authority, which were Palestinian revenues that should have been for the Palestinians anyway, and European, Arab, Japanese, and American funding that came to the PA, mm-hmm. It just became a thoroughly unhealthy situation.
Right.
Already you had patronage. Already you had corrupt means being employed. But the system simply was incapable of retaining any kind of integrity.
Right.
And when the system was somewhat rectified in the last decade or so, all that meant was, in a sense, corruption was regularized, corruption was institutionalized, and these kinds of perks. I mean, drive around Ramallah. You think you're in Amman.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a liberated country. This
mm-hmm.
is not even a... This is not a nation state.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a sovereign entity. This is not the capital of anything.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a vast, booming... It's a green zone
mm-hmm.
with buildings going up mm-hmm. and fancy offices and expensive cars and restaurants where people spend fortunes.
Right.
This is a very unhealthy situation.
Okay, this leads to the next question. Given the failures and the colossal disaster of the past, the question now is... What about the future?
Mm-hmm.
I think most people would agree, at least most Palestinians, I think, will agree that the current leadership under Abu Mazen and his gang have been equally as bad as the previous leadership under
worse.
Arafat. Worse.
Okay. Oh, worse. So, I mean, look, the Arafat leadership,
yeah.
in my view, messed up
right.
systematically. And you can go back, talk about the 70s, or you can talk about the 80s. You certainly right. can talk about the 90s.
Right.
But they at least had some achievements
right.
to their credit.
Okay.
I mean, they created the PLO.
Right.
So they put the Palestinians on the map.
It's gotten worse now.
They got yeah. the Palestinians yeah. recognized.
Right.
They survived Lebanon. I mean, these are not inconsiderable achievements.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're not talking about a struggle where the Palestinians were equal to the Israelis, and yet the PLO managed to survive. So for all their failures, their failures of strategy and their excesses and so on and so forth after they returned to Palestine, that was a generation... which could claim some things to their credit. I think that since the 90s onwards, it's been a catalog of catastrophes and disasters for the Palestinians, which this leadership bears a huge share of the responsibility for, without any, in my view,
right.
any countervening benefits that they've provided. The good things that have happened, that the Palestinian Authority has done, have been essentially the work of Palestinians from the occupied territories,
right.
creating structures that were already there under occupation
right.
and developing them.
Right.
And it's been civil society rather than the state that's done the best things.
Right. So this leads to the big question, what about the future, and why aren't Palestinian intellectuals like yourself saying, look, enough is enough. We need to chart a different path. We need a 180-degree turn. This current leadership does not represent us. It doesn't represent the West Bank or Gaza. It certainly doesn't represent the Palestinian diaspora. We need a completely new vision for Palestinian nationalism. We will thank the leaders of the past. We're moving in a completely different direction. A new charter, a new assembly, a new vision to model a serious and credible Palestinian leadership on the model of what the ANC did and what other successful national liberations. Why
right.
isn't that happening now? It seems to be crying out for an answer, but I see no movement moving in that direction.
I attend conferences and meetings and so on in Palestine. I was there in September
yeah.
a month ago. And... One of the striking things is the degree to which the tone has changed in these kinds of meetings of the kind of people you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
In terms of an increasingly critical and future-oriented critique of the all of these things that we've just been talking about, an attempt to lay out a path towards the future.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, I am not personally a believer in the idea that intellectuals lead political movements. Intellectuals sometimes lay down some paths
right.
that movements follow.
Right.
You know, people like Mahmoud Darwish, people like Edward Said, mm-hmm. played a role. But the person who pushed some of the projects that they were engaged in was actually either Yasser Arafat mm-hmm. or Salah Khalaf Abu mm-hmm. Iyad. The guy who won the PNC over mm-hmm. by his speeches was not Edward or Brahim Abu
right.
Ubud
right.
or these... or Iqbal Ahmed or Mahmoud,
right.
these incredibly important intellectuals who were pioneers in all kinds of spheres, including the political.
Right.
It was bruisers who were able to do politics in a way that no intellectual I've ever met has been
right.
able to do,
right.
who pushed things through. And that is what is lacking, in my view, in Palestine.
Right.
I know literally scores of Palestinian intellectuals, literally scores, some in the diaspora, some in Palestine, some in the Arab countries, the far diaspora, the Arab countries in Palestine, who have the analysis that you and I are talking about, and more, and better.
Yeah.
And they know it better than I do. I'm living in New York,
right.
for heaven's sakes. But what we really lack are a political leadership that's able to translate that into actual new tactics.
Right.
The Palestinians lack several things. They have to have a reunified national movement.
Right.
They have to have a consensus on how they want to approach the situation. How are we going to deal with this status quo?
Right.
How do we change it? Do we focus on occupation?
Right.
Do we focus on integration within Israel? How do we deal with an international consensus which accepts the absolute legitimacy of an Israeli
right.
state, which as defined in the 1947 partition resolution is a Jewish state,
right.
not the Jewish state that Netanyahu is talking about, but nevertheless,
a Jewish
that's
state.
The language. How do you transcend that? I mean, there's so many questions that are not just intellectual questions.
Right.
They're questions that have to be turned into something that ordinary people can understand
right.
and mobilize around. And I'm really sorry. I know a lot of intellectuals. I know very few of them who are able to mobilize people
right.
around. They can put forward the ideas,
yeah.
but that has to be part
well, that's
of
what
it.
I'm asking. The ideas aren't even out there on the table.
Oh, yes, they are.
Claiming or putting
I mean,
together
the conference I was at. The conference I was
so
at.
So they're there. They're circulating.
In Ramallah.
Yeah.
In September.
These conversations were taking
place? Was 20 years after Oslo.
Right.
And many of these ideas I'm talking about are not my ideas.
Right.
They're things that other people were saying.
Yeah.
In the course of 2 days.
So what has to happen in order to materialize them, concretize them, make them move
I think,
in the direction?
I think circumstances have to change.
Yeah.
And they may change, you know, nobody expected the 1936 revolt to start
right.
when it did. This was an event that the leadership and intellectuals were completely surprised by. Now, people who had watched Sheikh Izzeddin Qassem's funeral,
right.
like various intellectual observers in 1935, said, oh my God, there's a popular movement brewing here that's going to lead to something.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It erupted in 1936. And it was led partly by intellectuals, partly by political activists,
mm-hmm.
mainly young people, in rebellion against the then political leadership.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happened with the Fatah. Fatah's launching and the PFLP's similar moves in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
These were people, few of whom were intellectuals or school teachers or whatever,
yeah.
but others of whom were just political activists
yeah.
and who launched this. Nobody was expecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the same thing about the First Intifada.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not saying that it needs that kind of... It doesn't need necessarily an uprising, but you have to have a start which has to come from the political situation,
yeah.
from people... not from intellectuals. I think for those ideas then to fertilize
yeah.
a movement. That's what happened in the First Intifada, by the way.
But don't you need to have, as a sort of a precondition, a clear statement by someone that, look, this peace process is not of our interest.
Where was the clear statement in 1936? The strike started,
yeah.
and they issued an appeal.
Yeah.
It was in the wake of a strike, which sort of was spontaneous.
Yeah, but there's no peace process then. Now everyone's waiting
that.
To see what happens
I
in these negotiations.
No.
We all know they're not going to lead anywhere.
No,
for
people
anywhere.
Are not waiting for the...
Okay.
I mean, some people are.
Yeah.
But the kind of people we're talking about are not waiting.
Right.
I mean, if you look at what's happening in refugee camps today, there in the West Bank, there is clear dissatisfaction brewing with the PA. Now, the PA has, the Palestinian Authority, has unlimited capacities
mm-hmm.
to subvert, to co-opt,
mm-hmm.
to buy, to use patronage to neutralize, especially stuff in the camps.
Mm-hmm.
Because the situation is so terrible
right.
in Jenin or in Balata or in Dehesha or any of these.
Say nothing about the Lebanese camps.
It's not going to start in the Lebanese camps.
Here.
It's going to, the Lebanese, the
right.
arrival of
okay,
refugees
from
Syria
right.
has made the Lebanese camps a catastrophic
right.
situation.
Yeah.
The population of these camps is just increased by 100% maybe,
right,
or 50% in some cases, by the arrival of probably 100,000 people,
right,
from Syria,
yeah,
who are destitute,
yeah,
and who immediately go to their relatives or the people they know, or people from the same village, mm-hmm, in the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. So it's not going to start in Lebanon. It's not going to start in Jordan.
Right.
Jordan's too well policed.
Right.
It'll start in the occupied territories, in the camps in the West Bank and maybe Gaza. And there you have a simmering discontent.
Mm-hmm.
In the villages, you have simmering discontent. I'm not saying that's going to erupt. Something may happen, something may not happen. The security cooperation between the PA, between Israel, is such that it's going to be very hard for certain kinds of things to happen. On the other hand, you never know.
Right.
There was the same security cooperation at the time of the Second Intifada. And the Second Intifada turned into, I think it was a catastrophic disaster for the Palestinians, but it was unmanageable,
right,
uncontrollable by any leadership for the better part of 2 years. So I think it will be some shock that might lead to the possibility of a change. It may be the failure of this negotiating process. I don't know. I hate to predict.
Right.
And you're a political scientist.
Right.
You try and think about how things are changing,
right,
and where they might go. As a citizen, as a political analyst, you know, as a human being, I like to think about those things. But I don't like to predict. I look back at history. Nobody saw the 1870 commune. Nobody saw that coming.
Right.
Things just happen.
Yes.
And then we historians with hindsight can go back and analyze,
right,
why.
Right. Okay, Rashid, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed the conversation.
Pleasure, Nadia.
Thanks, take care.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Columbia University Rashi Khalidi speaking about the past, present, and future of the Palestinian leadership. And now a change of pace. Our next presentation is another courageous Palestinian voice, one we've enjoyed before on This Week in Palestine. It is that of architect, author, and storyteller Suad Amery, speaking about the journey of her family following the Nakba, highlighted by commentary on some of her writings. Here is an interview of Suad Amery by Riz Khan on the now-defunct Al Jazeera English Network.
Hello and welcome. For a Palestinian woman, she leads a very unique lifestyle, one that centers around her experiences as a refugee from her homeland and the need to preserve its architecture, but one that also recognizes her people need a human face. This week on 101, meet the award-winning Palestinian author, activist, and architect, Suad Amery. As a child, she only knew her homeland through the stories of a Palestinian refugee family. But growing up, Suad Amery felt a piece of her life was missing. There came a voyage of self-discovery as she returned to the West Bank town of Ramallah in 1981 as a tourist, eventually making it home. 10 years later, she was on the Palestinian peace delegation looking for solutions. Around the same time, she founded the Rawak Center for Architectural Conservation to help preserve at least something of Palestine. Suad Amery has also discovered the power of writing and realized that through her books, the real story of the Palestinian people can still be told. Well, Suad Amery, it's lovely to have a chance to chat with you.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Good to talk with you. Now, your writings have a very personal touch to them. It's really pretty much your life story, but also the situation of your people and the situation in the Middle East through your eyes as well. And you put a very human face on it, mm-hmm, which the mainstream media tends to miss,
right,
you know, being very much, I guess, conflict-driven. I don't know. How important is it to put a human face on such conflict, to give the Palestinians a human face, so to speak?
Well, I think it's most important. As you said, the television is always interested in death, unfortunately. When you talk Palestine or you say Palestinians, everybody feels sad or everybody shrinks. And my books are really about everyday life. For me, occupation means that you are forbidding 3.5 million Palestinians just having a normal life. So my books are really about people who want to live, the Palestinians as a nation who want to live. And, you know, my books are about my mother-in-law, about my husband, about my dog, myself. And I think one of the most most important thing to relate to a nation is to see the similarities with that nation. And that's what I try to do in my books, is just to remind people that really Palestine is about, the occupation is about forbidding people just to go to the movies, to get to school, to go to nurseries. So I think that's why my writing is more about why we want to live, and people should allow us to live and help us to live.
You say that you like to draw on your own experiences rather than construct a world.
Right.
And I mean, that means really you're drawing on all the stories you have. But when you start traveling, when you're away from, well, you're now back home, so to speak, but when you're away from that sort of area, it must be hard to get those stories.
Well, I think, you know, in my two books, Sharon and My Mother-in-Law and Nothing to Lose But Your Life, I think many people relate to them, especially people away, because when you're away, you tend to romanticize Palestine, many of the Palestinians, or many of the people are scared of getting to Palestine. So my writing is about reminding people that this is a normal place where people love and die and go to school. And there is no romanticizing whatsoever in my writing. I mean, it's just like there are betrayers, there are people who love, there is a mother-in-law who's driving me crazy. And so this is what I'm trying to give the details of everyday life in Palestine.
Now, you were born in Damascus in Syria.
Right.
Just a couple of years after your parents were lost their home in Palestine.
Right.
And they were essentially refugees.
Right.
How much of that sense of loss permeated your early childhood?
A lot, actually. You know, my father is from Jaffa, and in 1948, my parents, my mother and my father, were living in West Jerusalem. And in 1948, they were kicked out of their home, and they went to live in Ramallah, and soon enough, we were in Jordan. I grew up in Jordan. I was born technically in Damascus because my mother was Syrian, but I grew up as a refugee in Jordan. And the loss of the homeland over there is quite strong, actually. I mean, in one of my books, I talk about going back to search for my father's house in Jaffa. And it was amazing how much childhood, you know, in a culture like the Arab culture, I'm sure in India and Pakistan and many of these countries, what your parents tell you every day lives, it's part of your memory. I was surprised how much I knew about my father's house in Jaffa. He used to describe how, as a boy, he used to go to the sea with his towel on his shoulder, he would walk, and all of these images were with me. Like the diaspora, 5 million diaspora Palestinians, you carry that with you. And sometimes, actually, it's very tiring. I always say, if we ever want compensation from the Israelis for losing our homeland, it's for that memory and that heaviness, you know. You are reminded every single moment of your life that you are a Palestinian. And that's heavy. That's heavy.
Your early years, they were interesting. You were pretty much a tomboy out there playing with the boys.
Yes, I mean, I am lucky in a way, I must say, because my mother is Syrian, and I grew up in Damascus, and my mother came from a sort of relatively rich family, and we lived in a beautiful house, and I think those images have a lot of has a lot of influence on me as an architect. Now, the tomboyishness is, as a little girl, I always liked to play in the street, you know, and I always wore a hat and wore shorts, and I wanted to look like a boy. And my mother always had difficulty with me because, you know, I'm off playing, but at the same time, if anybody thought I was a boy, I was be very, very disappointed.
But she encouraged you to play with the boys,
yes,
didn't
yes.
she?
Yes, I think I was very lucky from both my parents. I mean, my father, being Palestinian, education was very important for him. So he wanted us to be all very educated. And as a result, three of my sisters were, you know, PhD holders. My mother was a very strong woman, a woman that did not fear anything in her life. And I think, you know, you get influence, of course, from your father. I think I was influenced by my father with his values. I think his experience as a refugee and having to make it in life gave him him a strong sense of fairness. So I learned my values from my father. But the strong characters and the toughness is really came from my mother. And yes, go. You know, my mother was very open-minded and, you know, play in the street, go to Damascus on your own when I was 9 years old. So I had this kind of freedom in my family that really affected me and gave me a positive outlook to life.
Now, you went off to Beirut to study.
Yes.
So a change in environment there. How did you adjust to the Lebanese environment?
Actually, Lebanon was one of the important moments in my life. You know, Jordan at the end of the day is a small country compared to Lebanon. I went to Lebanon in the early 70s. And if you recall, Beirut at that moment, it was a political, very active culturally, very active politically. And actually, the only time I became aware that I was Palestinian and sort of active was in Lebanon. But more important, I think in Lebanon, I was exposed to the world. I mean, the American University of Beirut had people coming from Iraq, from Yemen, from India, from name it. And I was open. You know, it's a place that made me realize that a human being is beyond your family. The world is your family. And, you know, I talked about being influenced by my father and my mother. But I think we have to always remember that who we are by accident. I mean, I don't take credit neither for my nationality nor for my religion. But I take credit, if I want to say, by what I become as life goes by. So Beirut was really a place where I learned to be the a human being, a daughter of this world, and not necessarily. But at the same time, that was the time where the PLO was very active. And that was also, on the one hand, I felt very international in character, but that was also the time where I felt very Palestinian. I developed my consciousness as a Palestinian because of the PLO being in Lebanon early 70s.
Why pick architecture, though, to study architecture?
I can't tell, to tell you the truth. I mean, I can reflect on it. As I told you, being in the old city of Damascus, I'm sure you have been to Damascus, and you can see the images that Damascus leaves on you. My grandfather's house was a beautiful old house. And now when I work in conservation, I try to think maybe this left an impact on me. Later on, I wouldn't be surprised that the loss of Palestine really had an impact on me, because I grew up with my father telling us that Israel, between 1948 and 1952, demolished 420 Palestinian villages, erased them. And I always had this fear that Palestine is physically disappearing. And I think I came back to... I wasn't aware of that. I mean, later on, now I think of it. Why am I working in conservation of historic Palestinian buildings? I think there is a lot of insecurities inside us that one become aware of when you grow up. I also had, my mother had a woman friend who was really, she was an interior designer. Again, she was fourth grade. I mean, she was like very educated, but she was very, very cultured. And she did a lot of interior design for King Hussein and the royal family. And I must have been impressed by her also.
It's very sad. When your father passed away in 1978,
yes,
30 years after he'd been forced out of his home,
right,
in Jaffa, he'd never got to go back and never got to see it. That really was...
No, actually, my father did. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because in 1967, my father decided to go and see his home in Jaffa, and he made the trip, actually, and he found out that there was a Jewish family, of course, living in that house, and there was a barber shop in their shop down. He knocked at the door and tried to go inside to see that house, and he couldn't, they wouldn't allow him in. My father came back. He was very, very distressed by that experience. And actually, I couldn't make the trip.
So to this day, you've not had a chance to see your father's home?
I mean, I went to Palestine in 81 to teach at Birzeit University. And of course, the first thing you want to do is to go to your father's house. But I just could not go through that. I never saw it, so I don't even know whether it still exists or not.
Well, you've done some remarkable things. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Yeah. We take a short break here. More one-on-one with Suad Amiri when we return. Welcome back. You're watching 101. We're speaking with award-winning Palestinian writer and activist Suad Amiri. There was a turning point in your life when you decided in 1981 to go to Ramallah. It's where you actually met the man you ended up marrying.
Right,
Salim.
How
was the adjustment going back to essentially your homeland?
Right. Well, it's quite an interesting experience, actually, because, as I said, I grew up outside of Palestine, and, you know, you live on stories, you live on images. And really, one day, I just woke up and decided I'm going to go to Palestine and teach at Bir Zeit University. And my mother, of course, thought I was totally crazy. And she tells me, everybody runs from occupation, and here you are going to live under occupation. I went to Palestine, and I must say I didn't know it. Of course, I took a car and drove everywhere. I must say that it was very beautiful, and still I find it very beautiful. Of course, I had a very strong sense of being a stranger. And especially if you go to Jaffa or to go to historic Palestine for a Palestinian, it's very, very painful because you don't recognize the place. You don't know what language to speak when you're in Haifa or in Jaffa. It's a place that makes you feel very, very, very sad.
It was a political decision, not just connecting with your roots, wasn't it, to go to Ramallah?
It was sort of really wanting to be in Palestine because it's very harsh to be away from Palestine. You know, I see my sister who's in America, or I see my sister in Jordan, and Palestinians in diaspora. I think one of the most problematic things in life is to have that yearning for a place. And I decided it's better to be in that place with all its difficulties, even under the difficult Israeli occupation. I'd rather be in the midst of it than being outside and sort of romantic.
Tell me about your time when you came to Washington in the early 90s as part of the Palestinian Peace Delegation.
Yes, well, that was a great experience for me because I did spend a lot of my life trying to really to explain to the Israelis why the Palestinians want to have a state. I mean, listen, I'm from Jaffa, and it's a big, big, big compromise to anybody from Jaffa to tell you I accept a two-state solution. And for me, this is the saddest thing about the Israelis. The Israelis don't realize how much concession we have made to recognize them, to accept them. But at the end of the day, you realize that they haven't accepted us. When you are in the negotiations, you realize how unserious the Israelis are about negotiating with us. Because they would come into the room, waste time of calling Yehuda and Samira instead of calling it the occupied. We will spend a whole session saying, no, this is the occupied territories. They would say, no, this is not occupied territories. And they would go on and on and on. And we realize, I mean, really, I realize that many times the Israelis just want to be in the negotiations to gain time.
When your mother passed away in 2005, I know you were very sad. She'd never had a chance to visit your home in Ramallah.
She wouldn't
go to the occupied territories, would she?
No, my mother was very Syrian in that respect. What I mean by that, you know, many of the Arabs, first of all, you have to realize technically it's impossible for the Arabs to arrive to the West Bank. I mean, you need a permit to the Israelis. Now the Israelis don't give any permits, not even to the Jordanians with whom they have made peace. And of course, it was very sad for me to have my mother pass away and not to see my home in Ramallah. She never visited me in my home.
Did you get a chance to read your first book, Sharon and My Mother-in-Law?
Oh, yes, yes.
It had just come out soon.
It has just come out. And my mother-in-law, the book was about her.
How did she react? The story's interesting, isn't it? It's all about emails exchanged when you were stuck
in... Yeah. Well, it all happened when the Israelis attacked, occupied Ramallah in 2002 and 2003. And my mother-in-law, who was 91 years old at that time, came to stay with me. And the Israelis put us under curfew for 41 days consecutively. And I always tell the Israelis, I may forgive you one day for occupying us, but I will never forgive you for having my mother-in-law stay with me for 42 days. At that time, really, it was very tough to have the Israeli army outside the house and to have my mother-in-law inside the house. So at the end of the day, I started writing emails to friends describing what it means to have my mother-in-law. We were fighting on every little detail at home. At the same time, you have the Israeli tanks literally outside the garden.
Did she ever speak to you again after that?
Actually, she was very cute about it because the reporters will come to her and she would tell me, what is it all about? And I say, remember how the good time we had together? She says, yeah.
It was a bestseller as well. It was translated, 17 languages now?
19.
19 languages.
And Arabic was the last one, actually. But
really?
Yes, yeah.
What was the reaction from people around the world reading this exchange?
You'll be surprised. This book has been there since 2003 in Italy. Every single day, I receive a reaction from somebody, either an email or somebody. And the best reaction was from the Palestinian community, actually, because I was scared when the book would come in Arabic. Because, you know, Palestine is sacred and Palestine has to be put in big words. And here I am making fun of my dog. You know, there is a story in the book where I am using the passport. You know, there is a health passport of my dog. I take that health passport and I put my photograph on that passport and start going through checkpoints with a dog's passport, you know. And when the Israeli checkpoints stop me and try to figure out what's this crazy woman doing, and then I say, you know, this is my dog, he's from Jerusalem, she doesn't know how to drive the car on her own, and I am her driver. And so there were a lot of, you know, making fun of the situation, how difficult it is. And I was afraid that maybe the, you know, the Palestinians will miss the point, but no, I think that they were very encouraging.
Of course, in 2010, your book, Nothing to Lose But Your Life,
right,
was an interesting one, because for that, you became a man and went on a rather dangerous journey.
Yes, yes. You know, actually, that book really changed my life, because that book is about the Palestinian workers. Many people don't realize, really, if you ask me about the conflict of Palestine and Israel today, I will tell you it's an economic conflict. The Israelis, unfortunately, are trying very hard to make us very poor and very uneducated, and the circumstances are difficult. I had a worker come to work in my garden. His name is Murad. Murad is only 21 years old, and he started telling me what it means to try to get a job as a worker in Israel after the wall has been constructed. And he told me things, as a Palestinian living in Ramallah, I couldn't imagine that 150,000 of our people are going through this. So I decided, okay, I'm going to join them. And the only way to join these Palestinian workers is to wear, to be a man myself. And of course I was scared, because I would read the newspaper every day, and then I would find that the Israelis have shot dead or injured some of the Palestinian workers. To make a long story short, I decided I'm joining them. So yes, I took my hair up, I put a hat, I put on eyeglasses, and I wore jeans and part of my husband's clothes, and I accompanied the workers. But at the end of the day, only four of us made it to Israel, and the rest were arrested by the Israeli soldiers. Now, this trip was very traumatic for me, to realize this is what happens to the Palestinian workers day in and day out.
One thing you have done very much to try to help Palestinians is set up the Rewaq Center for Architectural Conservation, and that was in 1991 to basically preserve Palestinian architectural heritage. How much success have you had with that, considering how much damage has been done?
Well, it has been successful in spite of the difficulties. I mean, Rewaq is an NGO that was started in 91, and the idea is really to create jobs again. I mean, in Britain or in Europe, in Italy, you can preserve a building because of its historic value. In Palestine, we always have to tie conservation with job creation. And we have created a very successful program in which we work in the villages. We renovated historic buildings, but we try to make it job creation. The contractor has to hire people from the village, but also we have created cultural centers. We look at architecture not only as stones, but we look at it as an economic, cultural, and social development. And I think we have succeeded in doing that, in making that combination. And we have worked almost in 100 villages. We have documented. We have a lot of documentation about historic buildings. And as you know, Palestine has a meaning for every person all over the world. So we always feel a responsibility that we need to protect that cultural heritage for the sake of humanity, not only for us Palestinians.
Considering how much you've traveled and the way your family is spread out across the world, where do you consider home now?
You know, you're like a tree. Mediterranean, I can see the Mediterranean as an area, is home for me. But at the end of the day, until the day of liberation, I think it's very difficult to say except for Palestine. Maybe the day we have a free Palestine, maybe my mind would allow me to be to consider home other places.
How would you like to be remembered? What would you like your legacy to be?
As a person who tries very, very, very hard to keep my values in spite of the difficulties in which we live through.
So, Adam Miri, I wish you luck. Thank you so much
Thank
for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to an interview of Suad Amri by Riz Khan of the Al Jazeera Radio Network. That is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.